One of the financial backers of the documentary project was Causa International, a division of the Unification Church headed by the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, according to Antonio Betancourt, a vice president of Causa. Mr. Betancourt said yesterday that Mr. Shapiro, 38 years old, graduated from the London Film School early in the 1970s and from the Unification Theological Seminary in Barrytown, New York in 1978. Before that, Mr. Betancourt said Mr. Shapiro had graduated from Colorado University and had attended medical school at Oklahoma University. In July of 1986, a documentary that Mr. Shapiro had made in 1984 on the plight of the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua was shown in New York on Channel 13 of the Public Broadcasting Service. The documentary, Nicaragua Was Our Home, accused the Sandinista government of the calculated brutalization of the mosquitoes. The point being here, a couple of points, really. We've talked about the Unification Church in the past. The Unification Church is a very active wing of the U.S. National Security Establishment, in spite of the fact, obviously, it is a cult and a mind-control cult at that. In Radio Free America number 7, our program about the government's mind-control programs, we discussed the Unification Church at considerable length and went into its bizarre political philosophy in quite some length in a book called Gifts from a book called Gifts of Deceit. It's worth contemplating not only how bizarre their religious philosophy is, but the fact that this apparently is a philosophy which our government is willing to use, in spite of the fact that the Unification Church itself is actually was spawned as a wing of the South Korean National Security Establishment. Obviously, their National Security Establishment, in considerable measure, was spawned by our own and is very much connected to our own. So it's worth contemplating the government's active use of cults against the background of what we're going to be talking about this evening. Of course, in Radio Free America shows 5, 6, and 7, we went into the mind control programs by the CIA and military at great length, one of those recently broadcast on sister station KKUP in Cupertino. Now, we're going to go to the book, The Ultimate Evil. I'd like to review some aspects of it and discuss a little bit about what we talked about last time we dealt with this particular book. The book, by the way, is called The Ultimate Evil, subheaded An Investigation of America's Most Dangerous Satanic Cult. It's by Maury Terry, T-E-R-R-Y, published in hardcover by, by Dolphin Books, a subsidiary of Doubleday, copyright, obviously, 1987. Now, in the first part of the broadcast, we took a look at The Ultimate Evil, which links many of the most gruesome serial killings of recent years together. Specifically, it links them all to an organization which is basically a cult which has drawn from a lot of different sources. The name of the cult basically is The Process. It was founded by a couple of former Scientology people, and in fact, spin-offs from Scientology figure very prominently in the story of The Process. The Process is a religious cult with explicit satanic orientation, which began in England in 1963. Its founder was a man named Robert de Grimston, and the overall philosophy is one of worshipping Satan and the beast of the apocalypse, but it is specifically Nazi in orientation. David Berkowitz, the son of Sam Killer himself, as well as Charlie Manson, were known to sport explicit Nazi regalia and espouse explicit Nazi philosophy. The thing to remember about this organization, the cult, as it's called, the process, as it's called, is that it specifically is Nazi-oriented and obviously has very, very strong connections to elements of organized crime and in all probability, the U.S. National Security Establishment as well. A couple of the salient points to remember, in addition to the fact, by the way, you'll hear this cult referred to other names. One of its spin-offs is something called the Chingon Group, or I believe that's the pronunciation, C-H-I-N-G-O-N. That's one of the groups that operate under the umbrella cult of The Process. It should also be noted that a lot of New Age, quote-unquote, activities are in fact infiltrated by groups like this, and one of the points that Maury Terry makes is that a lot of the progressive consciousness altering organizations have in fact supplied members to this group willingly or otherwise. The group infiltrates these organizations. Many of them appear to be openly affiliated with The Process umbrella cult, and it's worth contemplating at considerable length the involvement of some people with this this type of activity, various self-help techniques, a lot of the sort of New Age mind control techniques for bettering, I guess, the quality of one's life, in fact, have led people explicitly into occultism and ultimately to the process. And again, the process is a mind control cult. It is explicitly Nazi in nature, and its main activities involve not only murder and the usual sorts of things one find in satanic rituals, such as mutilating animals and people, drinking blood, feasting on, you know, cannibalism, things of that type. But the main aspects of stock and trade, main aspects of the stock and trade of this process appear to be kiddie porn, which is something we're going to talk about next week in connection with the ongoing Presidio molestation case. Kiddie porn, the making of snuff flicks where people are actually murdered on film, usually in a sexual context, and also drugs are a major one of their major MOs, basically. They're heavily involved in narcotics trafficking, prostitution, in particular a prostitution ring involving college girls, and there are also a number of links to White Russian and German elements, too, strongly suggestive of an intelligence connection. Some of the other elements affiliated with the process, there's an organization called OTO, which is a German occult group, which was founded by Aleister Crowley, himself an individual with strong intelligence connections, and elements of Crowley's group have linked up with the process umbrella cult. And it's worth thinking, worth going into another aspect that we talked about last time, namely the fact that the satanic orientation of this particular group appears to be primarily a mind control technique. The people who actually run this organization, as we talked about last time, may very well not believe in Satanism at all. In fact, the satanic aspects of it appear to function partly as a front and also partly as a means of conditioning the lower down people into more brutal acts than they might otherwise be willing to commit. In Radio Free America number 5, one of the things we went into was the military's systematic deprogramming of normal social instincts in prospective mind control assassins by showing them films which are films of people being mutilated or dying in accidents, which gradually acclimate them to bloodshed and the inflicting of pain. It appears that many of the satanic activities in the process function in a very similar manner. And again, this is an organization which has been led, which involves the Manson family, it involves the Son of Sam killings, and many, many other disappearances and murders over the years. But again, the Satanism appears to be primarily a cover. The people at the top, the people who don't take the falls for these killings, don't appear to believe in Satan or anything else, and I would add, neither do I. I do not believe in the existence of a devil. To me, Satan is the first lone nut. It has been a very convenient way of people dismissing the evil in their own hearts. Oh, no, it wasn't me. It was Satan. He did it. You know, it really is sort of Satan is the cosmic lone nut, the first Lee Harvey Oswald, if you will. But again, the point about the process is that the satanic aspects of it, which are the most disturbing and the most vivid, that's merely a cover. And in order to really understand this organization, we get into kiddie porn, prostitution, drug trafficking, and things of that kind. These are the real aspects of the process that you want to know about. Now, we're going to get into the book, The Ultimate Evil, and the aspect of this particular organization that we're going to deal with this evening, again, concerns the murders that were committed in order to cover up this crime. I'm going to have to be skipping around quite a bit in the book. I may lose my place once or twice. If so, I can only counsel patience. I'm doing the best I can. Now, it would be very difficult to describe all of this. It's a very complicated book, and I'm not sure how easy it's going to be for me to describe the relevance of a lot of the killings that we're about to talk about to the actual Manson family and the Son of Sam killings. Suffice it to say that one of the things we're going to look into now are the deaths of John and Michael Carr. Those two individuals were the sons of Sam Carr. Now, David Berkowitz's cover story, which was that his cover story was that he was possessed by demons, that his neighbor Sam Carr had demonic control over him, and that it was his dog, Sam Carr's dog, that telepathically communicated to David Berkowitz in order to commit the killings. Many of the law enforcement officials from the very outset did not believe this cover story. However, due to the influence of certain people, notably Mario Merola of the Bronx, the late Mario Merola of the Bronx, David Berkowitz took the fall, but was allowed, his confession was allowed to stand. Now, as it appears, those of you who eventually get the book, The Ultimate Evil, it appears that Berkowitz was definitely involved in the Son of Sam killings, but he was only a participant. Two of the main people involved were the actual sons of Sam Carr, John and Michael Carr. They appear to have been involved not only in the 44 killings, but in the various other satanic and lewd sexual activities of this particular cult. Both John Carr and Michael Carr died under very strange circumstances, although there were some circumstances surrounding John Carr's death which suggests that maybe John Carr is still alive and that someone took the fall. There are many aspects of the corpse that appears to have been John Carr's that did not match the actual living John Carr. However, suffice it to say that as Maury Terry and many of the other people who investigated the Process Umbrella Cult began to look into the background of the Son of Sam killings as well eventually as the Manson killings, it began to emerge that these killings, David Berkowitz was innocent, and as they began to pursue others who appear to have been involved, a huge, huge number of deaths resulted. The first one we're going to deal with is the death of John Carr, or the apparent death of John Carr, a definite participant in the satanic activities that Berkowitz was involved with, a definite participant in the Son of Sam killings. And this is John Carr himself may very well have been one of the links between this organization and the military and intelligence community. When they began getting close to John Carr, we'll read you what happened. Again, from The Ultimate Evil by Maury Terry. On Saturday, February 18th, I was preparing breakfast when the phone rang. It was my mother on the line calling from a family home in Connecticut. "What's new in your little corner of the world?" I asked. "There's something you need to know," she replied. "What is it?" "John Carr is dead." At first, I refused to believe it. Then slowly, like an insidious riptide, the realization slapped at my heels, rose up suddenly, and swept me away with a thundering crescendo. "What the hell? John Carr dead? How do you know?" The questions flew in a staccato burst of confusion and panic. I don't know. There's a little death notice in this morning's Westchester paper. It's not a full obituary, just a small paragraph in that column of notices. No details or anything. Just that it happened Thursday in Minot, North Dakota. Dakota? Thursday, it must be somebody else. His car is sitting in the driveway on Warburton Avenue. I've been watching it all week. No, it's him, she insisted. Then are you sure it doesn't say he was from North Dakota? He's been out there on and off for years. It definitely says in Minot, North Dakota. What are you going to do now? I don't know. I never would have expected this to happen. I've got to reach Jim. I'll get back to you. Jim, by the way, is Jim Mitiger. I'm not sure how his name is pronounced. One of the people who investigated this with Maury Terry. Mitiger, in the midst of a lazy Saturday on Staten Island, was astounded, upset, and excited all at once. He's dead? For 6 months you chase a guy. He lives all these years just fine, and just like that he's gone after we turn him into Brooklyn and Westchester. This is one hell of a development, unquote. We then realized we had to learn just what had happened to Carr. For all we knew, he had been ill or hit by a bus. Mitiger volunteered to contact the Minot police to find out. A long, nervous hour later, he was back on the phone. Listen to this carefully, because you're not going to believe it. It was violent. Gunshot. And they think it's murder, although there's a chance it could be suicide. But they're treating it as a homicide. Either way, the guy is dead violently right in the midst of our handing him over. I was too startled to answer. And still later. Meanwhile, implying he was an official investigator, Mitiger cultivated a source within OSI, the Air Force Police Agency. OSI was involved in the case because Carr's death occurred in the bedroom of a housing unit on the Minot Air Force Base. Carr, it turned out, had left the Air Force 16 months earlier. The home was that of his girlfriend, Linda O'Connor, whose estranged serviceman husband, Craig, had moved off the base. One thing that's not mentioned in this particular section of the book is the fact that John Carr had obviously been involved with a branch of this satanic cult, the Process Cult, while in the Air Force and working as an F-16 maintenance man at Minot Air, or no, not an F-16, I believe F-106 maintenance man at the Minot, North Dakota Air Force Base. That's one of the deaths that we're going to be dealing with. Now, just as John Carr, by the way, he ultimately was found to have been murdered. It was made to look like a suicide, but a lot of these circumstances suggested that, in fact, John Carr had been murdered. Then, upon examination of the corpse during autopsy, there were actual questions raised whether or not this was John Carr, because a lot of things did not jibe with what was known about the living John Carr. So it's perhaps possible that John Carr is still alive today. Now, John Carr's brother, Michael, another son of Sam Carr, quote-unquote, was also being investigated and also appears to have been involved in all of the Son of Sam activities as well as the various Process satanic cover activities. And just as the investigators were getting close to him, he too died, returning to the ultimate evil. Ward County police politics was about to become the least of our worries. At 4 a.m. on October 4th, Michael Vale Carr III, a prime suspect, was racing toward a rendezvous with Infinity. As he sped north on Manhattan's rickety ancient West Side Highway at 70th Street, something happened. His pale green Buick plowed headlong into a streetlight stanchion at nearly 75 miles per hour. The impact dislodged the steering wheel and ripped the engine out of the car. At 27, Michael Carr was finished. Dave Hartley of the Yonkers Herald Statesman called me at 8:30 a.m. "I've got a photographer down there now. Maybe the pictures will tell us something." "Why, Dave," I asked, "aren't we sure that this is merely a coincidence?" Actually, I was dazed by the news. "Too many coincidences," Hartley replied. Again, there are many, many coincidences here, and we're going to take a look at some more of these deaths that appeared to have dogged this investigation at every step of the way. Again, one of the things that's chilling about this particular organization is how effectively they were able to eliminate suspects in the investigation. It appears probable from the circumstances surrounding this wave of killings that this group had strong connections within the law enforcement and intelligence communities. Now, one of the attempted murders that, fortunately for this investigation, did not come off was that of David Berkowitz himself. He had been actively cooperating with Maury Terry and others seeking to reopen the investigation. He himself narrowly escaped death when his throat was cut. Returning to the ultimate evil, in May, I received word from a source that Berkowitz's life was in danger. I immediately phoned Jim, who contacted Felix Gilroy. Gilroy sent a formal advisement to the correction department, warning that reliable informants said an attempt might soon be made on Berkowitz's life. It happened at about 8:15 a.m. on the morning of Tuesday, July 10th. Berkowitz, in a segregated Attica cell block reserved for high-security risk prisoners, was carrying a pail of hot wash water as part of his inmate's job as a porter when the razor slash came. The cut, which caught Berkowitz from behind, extended from the left side of his throat to the back of his neck. It required 56 stitches to close. A bit deeper, and he would have been dead. Berkowitz, with typical aplomb, walked up to a correction guard and said, "I'm sorry, but I've been cut." He was taken to the infirmary for treatment and refused to cooperate with prison officials in their investigation. He never revealed the name of his assailant, who was another inmate. And fortunately, David Berkowitz survived. A lot of other people, however, didn't. There's a huge, huge number of apparent suicides or accidents or obvious murders in connection with the investigation of this particular cult. Now, one of the places where this cult was very active was in Minot, North Dakota, and there appears to have been a whole wing of the Process umbrella cult there. And as the investigators began to pry into the Minot connection, many of the people there died. And just one second, there's another. I believe I've gotten my place a little bit confused here. Let's see. Yeah, no, we'll move along. We're in order here. More killings. Again, these are killings in connection with the Minot branch of the Process umbrella cult. The newly deceased was Jerry Berg, a cult-connected friend of John Carr's, whose name surfaced early in the Minot investigation of Carr's satanic associates. Berg, Carr, the now-deceased Donnie Boone, and Donnie Boone died under circumstances not described here, Phil Falcon, a person known as the Wiz, and a young man named Larry Malenko, M-I-L-E-N-K-O, comprised the inner circle in Minot. Jerry Berg, a short, stocky man with curly blondish hair, was a native of Bismarck who moved to the Minot area in the mid-1970s to take some courses at Minot State College, where Carr, Falcon, and some of the others also studied part-time. An accomplished outdoorsman, Berg had been on the wrestling team while at Bismarck Junior College, from which he graduated in 1972. He was 3 years older than Arliss Perry, who entered BJC in the fall of 1973. Interrupting, Arliss Perry was a person, apparently a Christian activist, who had been attempting to convert members of this satanic cult to Christianity. When she moved out to Palo Alto with her husband, who had was entering his second year at Stanford University, she was murdered in the Stanford Church in October of 1974. So this is a case which intersects directly with the Santa Clara Valley and with our listening radius here. That's who Arliss Perry is, however. On December 27th, 1979, Berg and Malenko were chopping trees in a wooded area outside Minot. According to Malenko, the pair had separated and were about an eighth mile apart. Malenko said the sound of Berg's saw stopped, and then he walked over to where Berg was working and found him crushed to death beneath a large tree. Malenko, ever respectful, then put the body in his truck, drove it to a hospital, dropped it off, and left. He immediately hired a lawyer. Berg was an experienced woodsman. He'd been in that business, Gardner said. It just seemed very strange to have something like this happen to him, let alone at the same time we're poking around about John Carr and Arliss Perry. In searching through Berg's possessions, police found further evidence of his satanic interests. In a letter Berg hadn't yet mailed to two friends in North Carolina, he said he was having difficulties with his brother, and he was thinking of putting a black magic curse on him, unquote. He also talked of looking up his black magic teacher, Aquarius Hador, H-A-D-O-R, Hador, who was, quote, now in Minneapolis. I'm sure he's as evil as he's ever been, Berg wrote. Ironically, he closed the letter by cautioning his friends to be careful in the woods, unquote. Police were never able to prove that Berg's death was a murder, but the toll of violently dead now included four who were directly linked to Berkowitz of the Son of Sam case: Jerry Berg, John Carr, Michael Carr, and Howard Weiss. Additionally, the Yonkers mailman who committed suicide a month after Berkowitz's capture, Andrew Dupay, was strongly suspected of having been threatened by the group. And then there were the near misses: sniper attacks on Gardner and on the police officer substituting for Wheat Carr's husband, Wheat Carr's the sister of John and Michael Carr, John McCabe, and the incident in which Darlene Christensen and Tom Taylor reported they were run off the road near Minot. There was no absolute proof that the latter incidents were related to the Son of Sam investigation, but strong indications were certainly present. Another incident, which occurred less than 2 weeks before Berg's death, was also highly suspicious. This one happened in New York. A letter I later received said, "Dear Maury Terry, please look into this double killing. Carol was asking people about the OTO a year prior to the murders." Interrupting, the OTO was Aleister Crowley's cult. That's one of the organizations which intersects with the process. "Carol was asking people about the OTO a year prior to the murders. I can't accept that the people responsible for this are still walking around free. I am afraid that the problem will not go away and that minds this unbalanced may perpetrate additional horrors. Forgive me for not signing my name. I haven't gotten over the fear," unquote. The writer was apparently a woman friend of one Carol Maron, M-A-R-R-O-N, 33, a Brooklyn resident. Maron was a secretary at the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn and designed clothing to supplement her income. For 7 years, she lived with Howard Green, 53, an abstract painter who drove a cab for his steady paycheck. As the letter writer said, for more than a year, Maron and Green had been delving into the occult. Their small basement apartment at 270 DeKalb Avenue was spiced with various items of satanic significance. Chances are excellent that this paraphernalia was purchased at a certain occult store located not far from their residence, a store that served more purposes than one for certain occult adepts. In the early evening hours of Saturday, December 15th, Maron and Green were spotted by an acquaintance on a subway train in Manhattan. The friend left the train at 59th Street, but Maron and Green kept going. The subway they were riding would carry them past Columbia University before continuing to the end of the line at the Bronx-Yonkers border. Sometime later that night, Green and Maron returned to their Brooklyn apartment. The next time they were sighted was at 7 p.m. the following evening. They were lying next to each other off Route 80 in West Paterson, New Jersey, not far from New York City. Both were bludgeoned on their left sides. Both had right eye wounds, and both clutched clumps of hair in their fists, a satanic symbol. And there was one other similarity. Every drop of blood had been drained from the bodies of Carol Maron and Howard Green with a veterinarian's syringe. And again, there were, as indicated in this particular passage that I just finished, there were a lot of other near misses for many people. We're not even going to go into those now due to time. But it's a pattern which becomes numbingly familiar when you've investigated political conspiracies for a while, just witnessed the flood of corpses that pursued the Iran-Contra investigation. Now, again, another murder here that appears to have been involved to cover up the Son of Sam Manson family process operation was that involving, again, now bear in mind that the activities that this group was involved in, the Satanism is just a cover and an apparent mind control device. The actual activities are murder, drug dealing, pornography, call girl operations, and kiddie porn in particular. The Vinny here, by the way, is a prison informant who helped break the case. One of the points that he makes is that certain people are selected for definite reasons and killed, and other killings are committed at random to cover up the significant killings. Now, again, Vinny here is a prison informant. Vinny named Donna Loria, slain in the Bronx on July 29th, 1976, is one of those deliberately selected for death. I would interrupt, Donna Loria was one of the victims of the Son of Sam, one of the .44 caliber killing victims. He further stated that some of the .44 shootings occurred at random to cover up the targeted incidents. He also said that a major leader of the group lived in a large, freewheeling mansion in either New Jersey or Long Island. that the group was involved in drug, porno, and call girl operations involving college-age girls, that shipments of illegal weapons were sometimes part of the picture, and that at least one Son of Sam murder was filmed or videotaped by the group. Without exception, these allegations were explosive, to put it mildly. They were also so complex and elaborate that we immediately suspected there was at least some truth to them. In the coded section of Vinny's letter, he was, I later learned, describing the murder of Stacy Moskowitz and the blinding of Robert Violante. Those were two other victims of the .44 caliber killings. Some of the coded names were said to refer to participants in that attack, which was alleged to have been videotaped by the cult. As Vinny later wrote me, videotapes, snuff films, the killing of Stacy Moskowitz is on film. It draws a high price. The sick bastards, but this is business. The whole Moskowitz killing was orchestrated. The whole capture was, by the way, that's the capture of David Berkowitz. Analyze the events yourself. Vinny didn't know Berkowitz had already revealed details of that operation to me. You'll feel like a fool, returning to Vinny's statement, you'll feel like a fool for ever having believed differently. Sickeningly, this whole nightmare is real. I have a good idea where the films and ritual book, The Log of Coven Crimes, are, but a premature leak could get them lost, unquote. Lost was one thing, dead was another, as in murdered on Halloween. As Vinny later wrote, I had two locations, Brooklyn Heights and the village, in parentheses Greenwich Village. I didn't know which was to be the place, except it was to be one of them. Berkowitz didn't know either, and he didn't know it would be that guy. When I sent out that code, I didn't know that the guy who turned out to be the victim was among those names. And why was he killed? He was afraid he was going down on drug dealing. He was about to help the cops, Santucci, to tell it all. By the way, Santucci is John Santucci, the district attorney of Queens, one of the five counties that comprises, or boroughs that comprise New York City. Returning to this passage, he was about to help the cops, Santucci, to tell it all, and he was going to make a copy of the videotape. And stills. They wasted him. It served a double purpose. The dead man was, logically enough, a photographer. He was referred to twice in the coded Vinny letter, first as Ronald, next as Sissy Spacek, unquote. His name, Ronald Sisman, S-I-S-M-A-N, and Vinny had written down his name 2 weeks before the murder, which occurred on the night of October 30th, or shortly after midnight on Halloween, in Sisman's Manhattan brownstone at 207 West 22nd Street on the fringe of Greenwich Village. Technically, the neighborhood was known as the Chelsea section. I would interject at this point, too. One of the things that the Process Umbrella Cult does is commit murders at or around times of satanic holidays or occult holidays. Halloween is one of those holidays. In December, Vinny, not even realizing that he listed Sisman's name in October, wrote to the same friend to whom he'd sent the earlier letter. The name, I believe, was Sisek, spelling. A girl and he were shot, a co-ed from Massachusetts. Sisek was planning a deal with the DA. He was going to produce the videotapes. Vinny wrote that Berkowitz hadn't told him personally about the motive for Sisman's murder, but that a mutual associate had filled him in. Vinny later said to me, Berkowitz had told me about Sisek, and he told me an inside job was in the works for Halloween. But he didn't say that Sisek, remember that's the coded name for Ronald Sisman, but he didn't say that Sisek was the planned victim. I don't think he knew it. He was getting info from outside, but there was a lag sometimes. But he knew Sisek before. He'd been to his brownstone with Michael Carr. He told me Sisek was dealing and that there was a party going on when they got there. He saw the chandelier. Berkowitz waited while Michael Carr got the stuff, unquote. As a confirming note, the building was indeed a brownstone and there was a chandelier on the premises along with a hanging Tiffany lamp. According to Vinny, Ronald Sisman had been at the scene of the Moskowitz-Violante shooting and may have videotaped the attack himself. If not, he assisted whoever operated the camera. It was either him or that guy Mickey Mouse in the coded letter. I have no idea who he is. I also think Manson 2 might have assisted the filming, but I'm not sure. Interrupting again, Manson 2 is the code name for a man named Phil Benson, who was one of the links between the Berkowitz killings and the depredations of the Manson family out in California. Remember, these have both operated under the Process Umbrella cult. Sisman, 35, was a Canadian native whom police described as a photographer, procurer, and dope dealer. He and Elizabeth Plotzman, P-L-O-T-Z-M-A-N, 20, a Long Island resident and a student at Posh Smith College in Massachusetts, were both shot in the back of the head, execution style. Her hands were bound behind her with a cord, his weren't. The apartment, as Vinny also predicted, was totally ransacked. And still more killings that appear to have been committed to cover up this group are to come here. Now, we've looked into a few, we're going to get into quite a few more. It's, as I said, it's a numbing toll, and one of the things that's so disturbing is the evident power of this group. And remember, it appears to be strongly connected with organized crime, with elements of our intelligence system, law enforcement. It is very well connected, and again, explicitly Nazi in nature. Returning to the ultimate evil, the sort of granddaddy of the New York wing of this cult appears to have been a man named Roy Radin. Now, Radin was very much involved with film production. He was involved with the production of the film The Cotton Club and other movies. He also achieved quite a bit of notoriety in relation to a sexual molestation incident out on Long Island. A woman named Melanie Haller, who I guess used to star in the Welcome Back Cotter television show, was apparently drugged and sexually violated and her violation videotaped at Roy Radin's mansion. When this began to come out, Radin, I've forgotten offhand whether he was actually convicted on the charges or not. He was indicted on a lot of different things, escaped most of the charges. In 1983, as this investigation of the Son of Sam Manson process link was proceeding, Radin went out to California, and he was murdered while in California. Disappeared, was found murdered while in California. Of Radin's death and the discovery of his body, Maury Terry writes as follows. At 11 a.m. on June 10th, beekeeper Glenn Fisher entered a desolate, dusty canyon some 60 miles north of L.A. On this warm morning, Fisher was searching for a suitable location to set up his hives. Down a rutted dirt path, he walked into the yawning hole known as Caswell Canyon. To his right, a dried creek bed blanched in the blistering June sun. Sagebrush, tumbleweed, and desert foliage splashed patches of color on the grainy, hilly landscape, and clumps of hardy trees flaunted their green resilience to the sizzling sky. At his feet, Fisher noted fragments of shattered clay targets. Someone had used the area for skeet practice. Whoever it was, the beekeeper thought, didn't belong to any Hollywood rod and gun club. Nobody but a desert rat would know about this forsaken place. Behind him, to the west, Fisher faintly heard the infrequent whiz of a passing car on Highway 5. To reach the canyon, one drove an hour north from L.A. and exited Route 5 at Hungry Valley Road. Turning east, a driver would then swing north again to traverse the dead-end Copco Canyon service road, which paralleled the highway before abruptly ending in a metal barrier. Beyond the rail, hidden behind a small thicket of underbrush, lay the narrow dirt road on which the beekeeper now walked. The path could be negotiated by car, but only by someone who knew it existed in the first place. Several hundred yards into the canyon, a hot breeze filled Fisher's nostrils with an unfamiliar, pungent aroma somewhat akin to flavored pipe tobacco. Across the creek bed, Fisher noticed a large green shrub which looked almost like a wide fir tree. It was thick, its full branches hugged the ground, and tall grass further hid its base from view. The beekeeper thought he saw something on the earth beside the shrub. Crossing the dry creek, Fisher hopped up the south bank and walked 8 feet to the dense branches. Looking down, he saw it. It was dressed in a dark blue suit and a vest, dress shirt, and tie. Four buttons were torn from the vest and two from the shirt, which was laid open. The suit's front pockets were turned out. Someone had removed the identification from whatever this had been. It was lying on its back. A Gucci loafer remained on the right foot. The other shoe was lying next to the body. The left hand was raised upward, grotesquely grabbing a low branch of the shrub. The body was mummified, and there was a large hole where the front of the skull should have been. Beetles swarmed in the hollow stomach cavity. It was, the horrified Fisher saw, the shriveled, baking corpse of what was once a large, well-dressed man. Now its weight was a mere 69 pounds, and it languished in the moisture of its own fluids, which still seeped into the earth beneath it. Fisher now knew what the bittersweet odor was. It was Roy Radin. And again, Roy Radin appears to have been the prime mover, or one of them, vis-a-vis the New York angle of the cult. He lived on Long Island, had strong connections to cultists in New York City and in Westchester County, north of the city. So much for Roy Radin. And again, he was a very well-connected individual. Appears to have been only one of the people involved in this particular situation. Obviously, there are many others around. Radin was killed to prevent the investigation from going still further and involving them. One another of the deaths that appears to have been a murder committed to cover up the growing investigation into the process umbrella cult was that of a journalist in Minot, North Dakota, named Jack Graham. Maury Terry describes his death as follows. Jack Graham was, at 29, fondly considered the bearded giant of the Minot Daily News. The husky, bespectacled, brown-haired reporter and a native of Washington, D.C., had joined the Son of Sam fray with an intense passion for ferreting out the Minot links to the case.
For a year, he'd worked closely with Jeff Nyes and me. Among other contributions, he was instrumental in tracking down John Carr's friend, Phil Falcon, on the West Coast. In August and September of 1980, Jack and I worked on an investigation of Larry Malenko, John Carr's cult-connected friend who was toiling in the woods with Jerry Berg when the falling tree crushed Berg to death. In early September, at a party he'd managed to infiltrate, Jack had an angry confrontation with Malenko. "We're going to get you, you bastard," Jack told him. 2 weeks later, Jack was vacationing in Michigan, visiting his family in East Lansing and attending Jeff Nye's wedding in a Detroit suburb. On Monday, September 22nd, he began his return trip to Minot. In the back of his Datsun were packed a number of wedding gifts he was bringing home to North Dakota for the honeymooning nieces. At 8:30 on the night of the 22nd, Jack stopped to visit a Michigan friend, Neil Colburn. Jack's arrival at Colburn's home was delayed because he had car trouble on the way. "It was stalling out on him," Colburn said. "He had road service before getting here, but was still worried about it. He went out later to try the car and came in and said it was stalling on him again," unquote. Jack and Colburn reminisced for a couple of hours. Jack had a bottle of beer and two Irish coffees before calling it a night at about 11:45. "He was in good spirits," Colburn recalled. "He told me he caught the garter at Jeff's wedding. He said he leaped for it," unquote. But Jack was never to know if that traditional ceremony signified an upcoming marriage for him. The next morning, after leaving dollar bills for each of Colburn's three children on the kitchen table, Jack was on the road before dawn. 4.5 hours and about 250 miles later, his car crossed the center line on a slight curve on U.S. 2 near the small community of Vulcan, Michigan, and slammed headlong into an oncoming 18-wheel trailer whose driver was unhurt. Jack was pulled unconscious from the wrecked Datsun and rushed to Dickinson County Memorial Hospital in Iron Mountain. He didn't make it. "The call came to me from a friend of Jack's, a source who was assisting the investigation. You know he was after Malenko," she cried. "He said it right to his face. Michael Carr was killed in a wreck. You've got to go after this. You just can't let it go." The matter would remain unsolved, and not being able to shake that lingering doubt was the worst result of all. Skipping down, by the way. The matter would remain unresolved, and not being able to shake that lingering doubt was the worst result of all. Whatever happened, another person deeply involved in the Son of Sam investigation was now dead, and he'd been killed just 2 weeks after confronting a suspect. Jack had departed Minot several days after that party and never returned. And we're going to come back with more of the killings that were committed, apparently, to cover up this particular investigation. In a few minutes, we're going to take a musical break right now. Realized, I'm going to go back, I'm going to backtrack a little bit and repeat more about this killing, because I just realized I forgot to start the tape deck. My apologies for those of you who will have to sit through this last portion twice, but ultimately this is going into the archives. And again, of the killing of Verisco, Anthony Verisco, and the killings of Robert Hirschman. McCarthy here is Tom McCarthy, a person assisting Rob Maury Terry in the investigation. I told McCarthy that I'd called the Westchester Medical Examiner on a hunch and learned that a young man named Anthony Verisco was slain in the recent past and had 666 tattooed in a triangular pattern on his hand, the same shape in which John Carr wrote XXO on the walls in Minot. "Who the hell killed this Verisco?" McCarthy demanded. "They said it was some squabble with a woman. It happened in Putnam, just over the Westchester border. So what does that mean to us?" "It means we've got another local murder victim, this one with a damned 666 on him. Maybe he was tattooed under his lip, too, but he's in the ground now." "Was this 666 thing on him made public?" "No, and don't forget you've got that 78 Hirschman case where he was blasted just above the Putnam line and his wife knocked off in Queens. He had that process-sounding Brother Tom and swastika tattoo on him, and his name was Robert, not Tom." Skipping down. "It's all bizarre," I said, "but not as bizarre as a lone lunatic claiming barking dogs told him to ice people. There were at least real motives, dope, porn, snuff films for big bucks, and of the Robert Hirschman killing," Maury Terry writes. "On Friday, January 6th, the day after the Brooklyn gathering, the bullet-riddled body of Robert Hirschman, 25, was found 100 feet off the Taconic State Parkway in East Fishkill, an hour's drive north of Yonkers. Hirschman, who had a minor theft record, was shot at least 6 times. He worked for a moving company and lived in Queens. The next day, his wife, Mary, 23, was found slain in a vacant lot near Flushing Airport in Queens, about 60 miles from where her husband's body was discovered. Fully clothed, she was slashed, stabbed, and strangled. The couple were married 7 months earlier and then separated for a time, but 3 days before the killings, they checked into a room at the Aqua Motor Inn in Queens near Aqueduct Racetrack. They were last seen there the day before their deaths. Hirschman's body was adorned with tattoos, one of which was a swastika with the words Brother Tom beneath it. Hirschman's first name was Robert, but Brother Tom was consistent with a process ranking and name-changing practice." And still more of the killings that were apparently committed to cover up the Son of Sam group and the process umbrella cult. The lieutenant's talking about the number of people who'd been bumped off in connection with this entire situation and the fact that on New Year's Eve, another occult holiday, they were expecting another murder. The lieutenant's words were morbidly prophetic. Not 4 hours after our conversation, between 6 and 7 p.m., 47-year-old Joseph Carrazza, C-A-R-O-Z-Z-A, was shot to death on his 41-foot yacht, the Sark, S-A-R-C, which was berthed at the Five Slip Yacht Club in New Rochelle, a city with multiple connections to the son of Sam Case. Carrazza, owner of a Bronx auto body shop, was shot twice with a .38 caliber revolver. He was estranged from his wife, Patricia, a nurse, and had lived in the marina for six years. A spokesman for the Westchester Medical Examiner's Office said that Carrazza, who was below decks, apparently began to climb a stairway to the main deck when he spotted his killer and tried to retreat below. One bullet was dug out of the stairway wall. Two others struck Carrazza from behind, one in the back, the other in the head. December 31st, gunshot, head, bizarre circumstances. The scenario was familiar. Peter Zari, Z-A-R-I, owner of the marina, told the Gannett newspapers, quote, "To the best of my knowledge, he was never involved with anything underhanded. He's not that type of guy to get himself involved in a heavy, and this is a heavy," unquote. The New York Daily News reported that an acquaintance of Carrazza said that when word of the murder reached a New Year's party at a country club in the area at about 9 o'clock that evening, a woman broke down hysterically and shouted, "I knew they were going to get him," unquote. For its part, the New Rochelle Police Department was stymied. Another familiar tune. "We're mystified completely," a department spokesman told Gannett. "I don't know why this guy got blown away. There's no immediate motive." Maybe not, which in itself said something to us. Mike Zuckerman, who periodically worked with me on the Sam investigation since late 1980, delved into the Carrazza killing for me for more than one reason. In addition to the dire warning about December 31st, Mike Novotny and I immediately suspected Carrazza might be linked to another suspect in the 44 case. Zuckerman's digging paid off. Searching through old files in a courthouse, he learned that Carrazza once underwrote a business loan for the suspect, a man Novotny and I thought could be the wicked King Wicker, the remaining Breslin letter alias. That's one of the many aliases for Son of Sam. In letters he supposedly mailed to, among others, New York newspaper columnist Jimmy Breslin, he called himself a number of things, one of which was Wicked King Wicker. That's the reference here. Zuckerman's research established the link. It didn't prove the cult was involved in Carrazza's murder, but it did conclusively demonstrate that Carrazza, slain on Vinny's targeted December 31st, was tied to a man previously suspected in the 44 case. As such, it was a significant discovery and almost certainly not a coincidence. The reason, if the group didn't commit the crime, who did? Throughout the 44 probe, I remained in the background while local police investigated the several crimes I suspected were tied to the Sam matter. My reasons for this were simple. I didn't want to be considered a gadfly, and detectives often resent reporters intruding into what they regard as their exclusive domain. Much later, when it was apparent New Rochelle's investigation was unsuccessful, I phoned the department and briefly outlined what we'd found, but the information wasn't made public. The killing of Joseph Carrazza remained unsolved. And still later, yet another killing that was committed apparently, or an apparent killing to cover up the process cult, was that of a mailman named Andrew Dupay, who appears to have had links, to the group, but knew a lot about the group because on his mail route were several of the people involved with the cult. And his suicide raises quite a few questions about whether it was really a suicide at all. Of the alleged suicide of Andrew Dupay, and remember, he was a mailman in the same neighborhood as the Carrs and David Berkowitz and other people connected to the cult lived and apparently found out about the cult activities. Andrew Dupay, 33, lived on Lincoln Terrace less than a block from Berkowitz and the Carrs. Dupay, D-U-P-A-Y, was a family man. He was married to the former Lori Heaton and was the father of two young daughters aged 5 and 3. Dupay worked as a mailman, and he not only lived in the Pine Street neighborhood, he also delivered the mail there, to Berkowitz's building, the two houses on Wicker Street, and the Carr home, among others. Stated another way, he lived and toiled in a war zone. It is not known if Andrew Dupay read the Berkowitz article in the Post the day before. If he did, it may have affected him. But he may not have read it because since early summer, something had been troubling him, occupying his mind. An outgoing, cheerful young man who reveled in his family, Dupay suddenly began to act frightened and worried in July. His family noticed the change, as did his co-workers. He said nothing to his wife, but told a couple of friends at work that he had a big problem. Dupay said he feared for his life. Quote, it just wasn't like him at all. He was not a paranoid person by nature. He said he was afraid for his life, but he never said why, said one associate who requested anonymity because of his managerial position in the Postal Service. Dupay's mother-in-law, Mary Heaton, told me in 1981, quote, "It was all so strange, so unlike him. There was no history of mental or physical problems. He didn't gamble, the marriage was fine, and he lived for his family. In July and August, he began to act fearful and edgy, but he wouldn't say why. There was, perhaps, a strong clue contained in a letter sent to the Gannett Westchester Rockland newspapers after I began publishing articles there about the conspiracy. The writer, who was a neighborhood resident on DuPay's route, said, "One day in July he told me, quote, 'Sometimes a mailman learns things about the people on his route he'd be better off not knowing, and he sees things he'd be better off not seeing.'" DuPay, the writer added, did not explain what he meant. On September 20th, at about 5:30 p.m., Donnie, DuPay, and Lori were bathing their two young daughters. DuPay excused himself, saying he was going to the basement to bring up something for the girls. At the bottom of the stairs, DuPay wrote a brief note. He then took a shotgun and killed himself.